About Putin, I can speak a lot. I met him a number of times when he was the head of KGB and then president. Once he told me, you know, I'm so frank with you and open, not because you're a minister of Israel, but because I read the text of your interrogations.
Is anti-Semitism really on the rise around the world? There seems to be a different standard for measuring right and wrong in the world, and people sometimes blame Israel for responding to the evils around her. Hi, and welcome to this episode of Inside the Epicenter with Joel Rosenberg, a podcast of the Joshua Fund, a ministry dedicated to blessing Israel and her neighbors in the name of Jesus. I'm Carl Muller, Executive Director of the Joshua Fund, and today we present Natan Sharansky's personal story of how he triumphed over truly difficult times and gives insight into modern-day Russia and Putin. Hear Natan Sharansky's testimony.
I was 9 years in prison. I was 9 years in the Israeli government, and I was 9 years the head of Jewish agency. So I can compare, and I can tell you for sure that the most hard time was to be in the government. Because when Bibi Netanyahu 10 years ago proposed me again to go back to politics, when he came back to power, I told him, you know, Bibi, I was in four different governments, and I resigned twice. For comparison, I was in four different prisons and I never resigned. So probably there is something wrong with my being. And then he once, was almost irritated. He said, so you don't want to have any public position anymore? I said, no, if you'll support my candidates to be the head of Jewish agency, I'm interested. He almost fell. He said, well, but usually the heads of Jewish agency want them to become ministers and not vice versa. I said, look, I believe that you are right that number one task is defending Israel against Iran. And she, on very early, 20 years ago, decided that is the main threat. But there is another problem, whether we Jewish people will remain one family, whether we will be connected to Israel. And that's something that I was dealing all my life. And I think I can continue doing it. And that's how I became the head of Jewish agency. Now, going back to the Soviet Union, and to those who think that we go back, you have to understand, we go also to the today's reality. Because I wrote my memoir, Fear No Evil, immediately after I was released. And it was fantastic. And I was straight taken by KGB from prison, brought by airplane to Berlin, crossed the Glinka Bridge from east to the west. And there already American ambassador took me through the bridge. Then Israeli, I met my wife, whom I didn't see for 12 years. And the Israeli airplane took me straight to Tel Aviv. And there, with all the people of Israel, we were celebrating near the Kotel, near the Wailing Wall. So straight from hell to paradise in 20 hours. So it was very dramatic. And immediately I wanted to share my experience with those who have to go through all these interrogations and all this pressure by punishing themselves, and how you can stand against it. But when it was published in Russian, Soviet Union was already almost falling apart. I was released in 1986. In 1988, my book was published in English. In 1990, it was published in Russian. In 1991, Soviet Union ceased to exist. So it was already, it was like stories about Middle Ages, all these interrogations. Today, two leading political prisoners of Putin, Karamurza and Navalny, maybe you heard these names. Karamurza just now got 25 years in Soviet prison. And he was, by the way, living in Washington, then came deliberately when the war with Ukraine started to speak against the war in Russia. And he just now got 25 years. And Navalny just now got another 19 years. And they both wrote me from prison through their lawyers, how this book, Fear No Evil, helped them, because that's exactly what is happening today. Wow. So finally, my dream became true, unfortunately, that I wanted that this book will work for those who are in prison, and now it works. So it's simply to remind you that what seems like the history, it's coming again, and we should be better prepared. And so in that struggle, and I was like activists and then spokesmen of two movements at the same time, Zionist movement and human rights movement in the Soviet Union. In that struggle, our problem was, no, we had many, of course, problems, but was that how to make the West understand what an awful society it is, Soviet Union. Because there was a lot of talk about human rights and equality and that nobody is hungry and everybody has a job, that you, the West, have your set of priorities, we have ours, and we are concerned about the rights of the people better than you because nobody is hungry and everybody is working and so on. And how to make the West understand how awful society, which is depriving people of the right to live in accordance with their beliefs, to have religion, to have national identity, and so on. And then came American president, President Reagan, who said the Soviet Union is an evil empire. And I remember for us in prison, it was like the biggest day of how we found out in prison. The Soviet newspaper Pravda, the only one which we could read, wrote a article condemning how dared the American president to do such an awful thing as to call us evil empire, we are another superpower, and so on. And I remember how we were really celebrating this when we found out we were talking by Morse or through toilets. Those who want to know how to speak from one cell to the other should read my memoirs. And because finally there is the leader of the free world got the essence of this empire. And we always believe that the moment the West understands what kind of society it is, that it's fully dependent on turning hundreds of millions of people into the slaves. And that's why it is weak from inside. The moment West will understand, the end days of the Soviet Union will be finished. And that's exactly what happened. And Reagan was explaining again and again why he believes it, Soviet Union, as he said, will be in the dustbin of history. And that's the time when many of your leaders, I remember the Senator Fulbright, who was the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, until the last weeks of the existence of the Soviet Union, continued to speak how important it is to have a normal relation with this superpower. And Reagan said, no, it is an evil empire, it is doomed, it's built on slavery, we have to challenge it. And by the way, and he played a very important role also in my release, he met my wife in the early stages, he immediately, and you can see it from his diaries, said that he'll do everything. And years after, when new leader Gorbachev came, and in Geneva they had their first meeting in 1985, and my wife, as always in those years, was demonstrating in front of the Palace of the Nations with some other Jews and non-Jews. And he told Gorbachev, we can continue saying that Sharansky is an American spy, but you and I know that it's a lie. But what is more important, then my people believe to that lady. They don't believe to you. So I cannot start improving relations while he's in prison. And a few weeks after, I didn't know about it, of course, but they took me from punishing cell, where I spent months and months, put to hospital. For 2 months, they were feeding me and feeding me and feeding and giving all the medicine, and then took on the airplane and brought to freedom. But I was the first political prisoner, and then one after another in 1 year, all the political prisoners were released. And then in another year, Iron Curtain was put down, and meaning that was not put down, it was raised. And 1 million Jews left Soviet Union. 1 million Jews left Soviet Union. And Soviet Union couldn't exist without Iron Curtain. So it, in 91, it simply fell apart. Now we have renewed efforts to rebuild Russian Empire, and that's why the struggle against regime and the struggle of Ukraine becomes so important for the future of the free world. And what is very important, not to be deceived with the statements that every culture is equal, we have the right on our values, they have the right to have their values, and let's learn how to live with them in their values. Their value is to destroy the individual, to destroy religion, to destroy national identity, and it cannot be our value. Now, a few words about anti-Semitism that I deal a lot, and CAM, an organization that I chair, who is our host also today, is the organization which is fighting to recognize international definition of anti-Semitism, and in a minute I'll say what it means. You know, in Soviet Union it was all very simple. It was, by the way, I had zero Jewish education in my childhood, and in the first 20 years from a while, zero, didn't exist. Bar Mitzvah, not Brit Milah, not Hanukkah, not Purim, not Pesach. These words didn't exist. And of course, no synagogue, and of course, no language, nothing. The one Jewish thing which we had, anti-Semitism. A lot of anti-Semitism in the street, but also discrimination of Jews on all the levels because they were not trusted. And it was so clear to everybody that when Israel is attacked, Jews should feel themselves insecure. And vice versa, when there is attack against Jewish, non-loyal, whatever, connections with American imperialism, that's the beginning of the attack on Israel. It was all the same. And for me, it was clear that that's part of this totalitarian regime, which looks for the... In order every totalitarian regime should be stable, it needs enemies outside and inside, that they can mobilize their people against these enemies. And there is no better enemy than Jews and Israel, both outside and inside, and use anti-Semitism for it. So for me, it was like clear that that's part of totalitarian regime. And that's why it was so upsetting when 20 years after, I'm responsible, amongst other things, in the Israeli government for fighting against anti-Semitism. And I find out that now it's not in totalitarian regimes, not in the third world, but in the free world, anti-Semitism, especially in the form of anti-Zionism, becomes like a natural thing. I remember suddenly after the so-called Durban Conference, which was a conference organized by the United Nations against racism in the year 2000, how the only resolution which came from this first conference against racism, the only thing which went out, that the new apartheid state is Israel, and we have to fight with Israel as we fought with South Africa against apartheid. And you think, okay, it's our enemies in Muslim world who want to destroy us. Who don't. No, we can see how one after another, some leaders of the free world, accept it. And when you protest, they say, look, Nathan, you should not confuse criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Because after all, when we disagree with Israel, we criticize it. And so I understood it's very important to give the criteria by which you understand when criticism of Israel, and Israel as America, as any other democratic country, should be criticized. In fact, we in Israel have as much a criticism of our government as anybody else. The one politician who stops criticizing our government will have no political future in this country. But when it becomes anti-Semitic, that they propose these 3D principles, demonization, double standard, and delegitimization. These were the tools of anti-Semites against Jews. Jews are demons. Jews are those who are using the blood of Christian babies. The Jews are those who are spoiling the wells. Jews are the closer to Satan in different ways. Or delegitimization. Jews are not legitimate religion. Now Christianity is a replacement theory, has to replace it. Or as Stalin wrote, that Jews are not a nation. It's not like the others. And so on, delegitimization. And double standard. Clearly, in Russia, there were special laws for Jews. In Germany, there were special laws for Jews. And even in the countries where there were no special laws, there was a lot of double standard. Well, you know, in America, in the 30s, there were many clubs or whatever, but it was written not for Jews. So these are tools against Jews. If these tools are used against the state of Israel, that's anti-Semitism. If somebody is coming, some respectable leader from the West, and says, I was in a refugee camp of Palestinians, that's Auschwitz of today. That's a real statement which was done. I say, my God, I was in many refugee camps. I think it's an awful place to be. I think it's awful that fifth generation, then it was fourth generation, of Palestinians living in refugee camps. And I can debate with anybody who's responsible for this and how we together can change it. But to compare it with Auschwitz, I was in Auschwitz and I was in refugee camp. It's two different worlds. That's demonization. Or when just now it is published in the books in Princeton University recommended reading, where it is written that Israeli army is harvesting the organs of Palestinians, or something which is very popular today on the campuses is deadly encounter. You know what it is? American police is brought to Israel, is taught by Israeli specialists how to beat black people in America. That's something which is repeated again and again and again in many universities. That's blood libel of today. That's demonization. That is anti-Semitism. And when Israel is the only country in the world which is condemned by United Nations more than all the dictators in the world together for violation of human rights, it's clearly double standard. Even if Israel is doing something wrong, but to say that we are doing something wrong more than Syria, Iran, America, France, Germany, and all dictators in the world and all the African countries in the world together, that's clearly that you have to use very different standards towards Israel. Then that's anti-Semitism. And BDS, they say, we have to boycott as we boycotted South Africa because of the Palestinians. Who's boycotting Iran today? Who's boycotting Syria? Who was boycotting Cambodia, which killed half of its population? Right. Who at this moment was happening in China with Uyghurs? You know, it's like to put millions of people in the big concentration camp. That's what. Are you boycotting China? Because are universities boycotting China? So BDS, even if you agree with the criticism of Israel, it's a big if. It's a very different standard which is applied to Israel than applied to the other countries. And that's anti-Semitism. And that's why it is very important to accept international definition of anti-Semitism, which connects anti-Semitism against Jews, demonizing of Jews, and demonizing of Jewish state. And that's what we are fighting for, and that's why it was very important that President Biden to put a very broad plan to combat anti-Semitism. But as I said, and we recognize IRA definition, that's international definition, and many others. The difference is that all the others are those who try to say criticism of Israel has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. So let's deal with the anti-Semitism against Jews and not deal with the criticism of Israel. And that we cannot accept, because anti-Semitism has many faces, and you have to understand it. Okay, so I spoke about Soviet Union, I spoke about anti-Semitism. I can speak about these topics forever because I am dealing with this all my life. I am both right-wing and left-wing. As a left-wing, I believe that Palestinians should have all the rights that we have, and they have absolute independent life. But at the same time, I believe it can be done only in the way that they cannot destroy us. And the only way is, like, helping them to build their own civil society. And if you simply give to dictator, to Yasser Arafat, control over any land, it becomes simply the base for the terrorist attacks against you. That was my theory. So that's why I resigned when they decided to do it. And I was the first minister who resigned about it. But I want to say that in one of the early meetings in the first government of Netanyahu, they were discussed again about what part of territories we should give to Yasser Arafat in order he will be cooperating with us. And I then said, you know what? I don't understand how you can decide that you'll give this part of territory, that without knowing where you go in the end. And they then explained how you're building strategy in chess, that you're trying to decide what are your final aims, then how you're reaching them on different steps. So build it from the end to the station, and then you're building specific moves. So you go twice, from the end to the station, and then building specific moves. And we are trying now to decide that we'll give something without knowing where we go, and discussing whether this will be more dangerous or that. You don't have to say. And then Raful, who was a great general, and then he was minister also in the government, said to me, Natan, it's so complicated. Maybe we should better play not chess, but damka. No, checkers. And I said, that is our problem, I said, that we are playing checkers, and Arafat is playing chess. He knows where he goes, and we don't know when. So that was my attempt to use chess strategy in politics. I have to say it doesn't work well, because politicians mainly don't think about the endgame. They think about the next elections. And it's very difficult to have strategy when you're thinking from elections to elections. Yeah.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Our verse of the day today is found in Matthew 19, verses 26. Jesus looked at them and said, "With man, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible." Our prayer requests today are, number one, pray that God continues to deliver Israel from all media attacks and misinformation. And second, pray that God grants people in Israel and the Middle East the grace to navigate difficult times and emerge victorious.
About Putin, I can speak a lot. I met him a number of times when he was the head of KGB and then president. Once he told me, "You know, I'm so frank with you and open, not because you're a minister of Israel, but because I read the text of your interrogations." So he thought it's like a big compliment that you were so strong on your interrogations, so I can rely on you. And like after 2005, approximately, I stopped meeting him and avoided meetings with him because it became too problematic for how I justify it to my human rights friends that they meet with this dictator. But he went through transformation. He was a KGB man who came to power through all types of controls which he built through KGB. But he seemed like a new type of a leader for me. First of all, he was not anti-Semitic, and I repeat it today, but he is awful war criminal. He is awful dictator. He's not anti-Semitic, meaning that he doesn't persecute Jews for being only Jews. And he explained me, gave stories how Jewish family helped him in his difficult childhood. And they're all true, by the way, but you know, but many anti-Semites have their own stories about their Jewish friends. He happened not to be anti-Semite, and he said to me that I believe it was the biggest mistake of the Soviet Union, that they decided that not to permit to Jews the life of the communities, that it is dangerous for the regime. I believe that Jews can be a good bridge for us with the West. And I have to say that many things that he said to me in the beginning were lies about Iran, and so everything was lie. But about that he will permit life of Jewish communities, was, until this day, it is true. But in those days...
But Jews don't believe that.
Yeah, no. He is not anti-Semite, but the world which he's trying to build is very bad for Jews, and Jews realize it. So that's why they are living, not like practically almost everybody, the leaders of Russia for 1,000 years, practically everybody hated Jews. But there were better times than less times. This time he does hate Jews, but he hates freedom. He creates a world of his own control. And Jews are the first to feel it, and they don't want to live in the world where they cannot say what they want. But coming back to what happened with Putin. Putin in the beginning, and that's why he was meeting me, by the way, he was looking for recognition. How he was irritated by the fact that the free world doesn't recognize him as a superpower. He knew that I have good relations with the leaders of America, and that Bush loves my books. So he thought that through me, he will send a message, recognize me, accept me, respect me. At some moment, it stopped me interesting him. Why? Because he realized that he is the only eternal leader in this political world. All these Bushes and Merkels and others, they can be 4 years, they can be 8 years, and then they go. And he really built from the very first year of his being a president, he built a system like this that he will be forever. First of all, he took care of the press, and even those who were strongly supporting him, owners of the TVs, he threw them away. He put his own people. Then he took care of the businessmen. Any businessman who was good to him but who was daring to give money to somebody else, he threw them away. And then he took care of the courts, that every judge has to remember who appointed him and for whom he has to work. And then he changed the constitution. So he is forever, not like all the others. And as the only leader who is forever, he has to think about eternal aims. And he never made a secret. He told you and me that he believed that the biggest tragedy of the 20th century was destroying of the Soviet Union by Gorbachev and the others whom he accused. I said, yes, not Holocaust. The biggest... Well, of course, for you Jews, it's great. It is a big tragedy. You know, I am a big supporter and so on. But globally, in the world, the fact that the Soviet Union was destroyed, that's the biggest tragedy. So, and for him, the biggest leaders that he wants really to continue them was Peter the Great, Ekaterina the Great, and Stalin. And here now he feels that when he's guaranteed that not like all the other leaders which are speaking against him and disappear. He is the one who will not disappear, and his aim is now to rebuild Russian Empire. And he started doing it quietly. He said from Caucasus and Georgia, and he all the time checked the reaction of the West. And Georgia was a surprise for him because Georgia is nothing but Turkey in a week. And then he had to, he took 20% of Georgia, but he had to retreat. So, but the world accepted that 20% are yours, only sit quiet. And of course, and then Chechnya, Belarus became his puppet, but the biggest challenge, of course, is Ukraine. And he was, and he understood that he cannot, he has to wait for the moment of weakness of the West. And this moment of weakness came with Obama making, not crossing the red line, which he declared about Syria and chemical weapons in 2014. You remember. And then he did two things. He sent troops to Syria and created the base. That's the reason why Israel has to be very careful with Putin today, because this base controls all the airspace of Syria. And the second thing, he went to Crimea. And when I said to Blinken that you realize that it's because of Obama's policy then, and Blinken was with about it. He agreed about Syria. He said it was a big mistake. I recognize it publicly. And Syria, we lost Syria because of this. But he denied then, it was before the war, that Ukraine, Crimea was because of this. And I told him, didn't you see how Putin was, he didn't go immediately to Crimea. He was testing for 3 weeks. He was saying, first there were some citizens who were unhappy with the policy, then some citizens who came from abroad, and so, well, it was, and every day he was testing what would be the reaction of the West. And when he understood the reaction of the world will be more words, he conquered Crimea and started his war in Donbass. And the, but he didn't, was afraid still to go with the war against Ukraine because he was afraid of the reaction of the world. And then there was a retreat of America from Afghanistan. And the way how it was done, how all the TV of the world was showing that how America is running away and cannot save, protect the citizens who helped them to Americans. And then some people in Kremlin told to Putin, well, he didn't even have to do that, somebody will tell him, but that now it is clear that for the next 10 years, America will not do anything. No, it's in such peril. And that's when he decided that's the time to start the war against Ukraine. And he believed that, first of all, he believed that really what he said, like, that Ukraine is not a nation. Well, they will not be happy, but they will not really resist. Why they should resist? There are no national values there that they will resist. So he really believed that in 3-4 days he will reach Kyiv. And second, he believed that he is the only leader in the world who is ready to threaten with nuclear. He doesn't need to do anything. He will threaten with nuclear war, and the world will do nothing. And he made some statements, and he organized tests of nuclear weapons just a few days before. And so, and for a few days, it seemed that it's working. And I was really scared when America started showing these signs of fear. And if you remember, just in the very first day, there had to be regular, every year America is making tests of their Minuteman missiles, even to make sure that they are still working. Yeah? Every year they're doing it. It's not something. And they canceled in order not to increase tension, not to be responsible for increasing tension when Russia already started the invasion. I remember I called then to American ambassador here and said, "You're crazy. Please tell my opinion to your State Department, because that's the worst thing. Is if you wanted to send message to Putin that his tactics of paralyzing the world by threatening with nuclear war, that's what you just now did." But then, first of all, Ukrainians proved that that national spirit is something very strong that Putin didn't really appreciate. They really had what to fight for. They fought for their right to be free people in their own land. Second, he didn't realize how corrupt his army is and how weak it is. And third, he didn't realize that at some moment when the free world really understands that there's a threat to them, they really are mobilized and overcome their fear. That's what happened. So, look, it's not a rosy situation. Ukraine is paying terrible price. America, on one hand, helps. On the other hand, it, sometimes it seems that deliberately does it much later than it had to be done. When I first spoke in the first months in Washington about tanks and airplanes, they said, what? You're great, tanks? We are discussing whether to give missiles for 50 miles or for 60 miles. What will irritate Putin? What is the border on which this irritation stops? So, thanks God, it's all overcome, it's doing. But each time, America is doing it a few months later. Like they said, made a decision to give their airplanes. Made this decision a few months ago. It was a huge decision. I remember, I happened to be in New York, and Garry Kasparov, we celebrated together this decision. Today, this month, when the Ukraine started 2 months ago, attack hoping to get American airplanes, it's clear that they will not be able to use them before December. So you have to understand that in the meantime, there is a very tough struggle. And though in every battle, Ukraine has an advantage because of its spirit and because of American artillery and so on, but the space is fully controlled by Russian jets because Ukraine still doesn't have it. So it's a difficult struggle. America and the Europe are really helping. And then I believe, I always believe that free world will win because it's really for fight for the future of free world. And really in few more serious victories of Ukraine and Putin will be very weak and then he will be overthrown by his own army because there is no chance for weak dictator to control a country. The moment he is weak, he is overthrown. It doesn't mean that there will be democracy in Russia. No, there are no civil institutions built, but the war will stop because that's the war of one person. Nobody has any invested interest in this war except from Putin himself. But it's very important struggle. And I came as a human rights activist. I was not very religious Jew. In fact, I was assimilated Jew. But the more you're fighting, the more you're strengthened by this national idea, which that we Jews have the great history and the great culture, and we should not be thinking all in terms of how to assimilate and not to irritate anti-Semites around you. The more you're thinking about it, the more you feel the power of the religious idea of having a mission in this world. And then as a human rights activist, I became involved with many other groups whom we were helping. I was one of the founding members of so-called Helsinki Group, where we were speaking on behalf of Pentecostals who were extremely persecuted, and they became like my big friends because we gave them connection with the free world to the first groups of Pentecostals. And the Catholic Church in Lithuania, which was persecuted, and Muslims in Crimea then who were exiled to Siberia, and many things. And you find out that to deal with the people who have strong identity is much easier because the chance that they will be working, collaborating with KGB is less. And then in prison, I really became very close with some Christian friends, and my closest friend, unfortunately, recently passed away, Vladimir Porish. He was not Protestant. He was, in fact, Russian Orthodox dissident church. But it doesn't matter. They were all Pentecostals and those Russian church who are speaking against authorities. We were in the same. And we were sitting in the same cell with him. And I was fighting for many years that they'll permit me to have my psalm book, which Avital sent me before my arrest. And he was fighting for many months to get permission to bring him back his New Testament. And then when we together happened to be in one cell, when they returned it to us, we started, so, as we called it, economical Reagan readings. Why Reagan? Because it was Reagan declared it the year of Bible, if you remember, in 84, I think. And again, we knew it from Soviet newspapers who condemned him for this. And we decided, well, probably it's pressure of America which permits us to have this. And these were Reagan readings. And he was reading something from, I was reading something from Psalms in Hebrew. He was then finding a translation to Russian, and reading something from a New Testament. He didn't try to convert me. I didn't try to convert him. But you're really feeling that, after all, we have one God. I will not go into discussion three or one, whatever, but we have one God and the same idea of freedom in the image of God creating the man. After all, what is the base of human rights? That's the only base. It all starts from the being created in the image of God. And that's feel, first of all, you feel something strong. And second, that that's the best guarantee that the people are near you are not KGB informers, because they have values which are more important than physical survival. Because KGB's aim is to convince you that physical survival, that is the only value. And the moment you accept it, you will be destroyed. They'll know how to make you cooperate with them. So you really must have values which are more important for you. That freedom is something more important than physical survival. Again and again, today, again, this hypocrisy is that peace is the most important value. Of course, everybody wants to have peace, to live as a free person in peace, not to simply peace of slavery. And that's something what really helps to unite religious people in Soviet prison, in fighting the Soviet regime, and which has to unite us today. Thank you.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode with Natan Sharansky's personal story. What a testimony of endurance and strength. If you found this podcast truly valuable, please get in touch with us. Let us know who you are. Do you want to talk about something else on this show? Do you have a question you want Joel to answer? Send any comments you have to podcast@joshuafund.net. Your feedback is incredibly valuable to us as we develop this podcast. And as always, you can check out our show notes for anything you heard on the podcast that you'd like more information on. For Joel Rosenberg and the Joshua Fund Ministry team, I'm Carl Muller. Thanks for listening to Inside the Epicenter with Joel Rosenberg.
I'm Dr. Lauren DeVille, a practicing naturopathic physician in Tucson, Arizona. In my podcast, Christian Natural Health, my guests and I discuss topics ranging from nutrition, sleep, hormone balancing, and exercise to specific health concerns like hair loss, anxiety, and hypothyroidism. I'll also interweave biblical principles as they apply throughout the podcast, because true health is body, mind, and spirit. Listen to Christian Natural Health for free at lifeaudio.com or on your favorite podcast platform.